Welcome to the Suffering Podcast. Each week, we walk you through how suffering is the way to sustainable success and the path to greatness. We are now available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and any other major podcast platform. Please subscribe and like to get the latest episodes as soon as they drop. You can always find our latest episodes at thesufferingpodcast.buzzsprout.com. Please comment. We may even read your comments on future podcasts and even reach out to you for a future guest spot. Like and follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Just search for The Suffering Podcast. Here you'll see links to episodes, updates, and inside information on how to achieve greatness through the joy of suffering. So get ready, sit down, and strap in. Strap in. We are proud to introduce the Dented Development Project. In conjunction with the Suffering Podcast, the Dented Development Project is a nonprofit 501c3 with a mission. That's to help first responders and their families repair dents caused by suffering. Visit us at DentedDevelopmentProject.com and get involved today. Helping us means that we can take care of those who take care of us.
Sit your ass down. Let's talk about the suffering. It's time to start the pain.
Sit your ass down. Sit your ass down.
And strap in. This is gonna hurt.
Let's talk about the suffering. It's time to start the pain.
This is gonna hurt.
It's time for the Suffering Podcast.
All new Suffering Podcast gear is here. The show depends heavily on our supporters to get the word out. Let people know that suffering is a team sport and no one is alone in their struggles. Wearing the Suffering Podcast merchandise accomplishes that goal. Check out our store at thesufferingpodcast.com or check our show notes for the link. Your support and love means everything to us.
When you're locked inside an ongoing battle, it becomes part of your soul. Defining our lives by governing every detail in your perception of normalcy. We need it to survive. The trauma and suffering become as essential as air and water. The absence of trauma for those in this place leaves a big giant hole. It's like walking out the door knowing you have forgotten something, but being unable to realize just what's missing. That absence creates a void that we fill on our own by manifesting suffering out of thin air. I'm Kevin Donaldson here with Mike Felice, and on this episode of the Suffering Podcast, we're joined again by our very good friend Brad Wadby, who will use his experience as a police resiliency officer to discuss the suffering of trauma drama. We're going to discuss how to fill that hole that the absence of trauma and suffering leaves with something positive and useful. Brad, great to see you again. Thanks for coming in. You've always been a great supporter of ours.
Yeah, appreciate you guys having me on again. I really do appreciate it. Love the podcast.
Brad, you're like a great friend to the podcast, and you've opened a lot of doors for us, and I really appreciate it.
No, I appreciate you guys, too. You guys gave me the platform to be able to tell my story, and hopefully it resonated with a couple people out there and helped them out.
Oh, it definitely did. But the cool thing about it is we were at that event for the Blue Magazine. And, you know, obviously you're hard to miss walking through. It's like a fucking tree trunk coming through.
It's like a fucking wall walking down the street.
It's like Moses parting the Red Sea. And here he comes. And, you know, it's just nice to see familiar faces when you're there. And it's like a big family.
No, it really is a family.
It's really cool to be involved in that in any way, shape, or form.
It's a bunch of like-minded people that are getting together to try to help.
And who understand each other.
Yeah, well, that's the big thing. It's who understand each other, because we've all been down that road.
Exactly.
Well, before we get into it, let's get into this week's social media question, and it's brought to us by Stephanie. And Stephanie writes, in your most traumatic experience of your life, if you could go back, what's the one thing that you would change or do differently? I think what Stephanie's saying is, in retrospect, is there a decision that you made that you would do differently in order to have a little bit better experience? Brad, what do you think?
Probably the most traumatic experience that I had was on December 27, 2018, when I had my gun in my mouth and was going to commit suicide. That day, I really wish that I had, number one, the courage to pick up the phone earlier and talk to someone. And number two, I wish I had the resources like the Resiliency Officer Program to help guide me through this. Because back then, even though it was 3 years ago, there was nothing like this.
Well, that's the funny thing. And that's where it's important that you've learned from your suffering, because you saw a need and a hole that where you can provide some assistance because of your own past.
Mm-hmm.
And you filled that hole by becoming that resiliency officer. It's real easy to sit there and pick apart all the problems with the world, but it's a whole other thing to step in and actually fix the issues that you see are broken.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, it was funny because yesterday I went down to Burlington County and spoke with the Attorney General's office regarding the resiliency program to one of the quarterly trainings that we're going to be having every year. There was a assistant prosecutor White from Ocean County. She talked about one thing that really resonated with me. She talked about reaching out to the psych director at the county psych hospitals, because you need to establish that relationship. God forbid a cop has to go there. She asked a question. Who here has ever been in the emergency room of a psych hospital? I raised my hand.
I actually can raise my hand on that one, too.
I took prisoners up there. That's about it, though.
Yeah, I raised my hand, and I have a friend of mine sitting next to me, and he just starts laughing. He's like, I think they mean as like an officer, not as a patient.
Well, you've been there both sides.
Yeah, exactly.
So you have a unique experience.
Exactly. So, but it was important because something like that, like I went in, I had no idea what to expect. Now I have that ability to, God forbid, an officer needs to go there. I can basically hold their hand and be like, listen, this is what's going to happen, brother. All right, you're going to do X, Y, and Z.
Well, that's the whole thing about this is you use your experience to guide them through that dark time.
Exactly.
Mike and I, we've talked about this all the time, where the tunnel's dark and you can see that there are other people walking side alongside you in that tunnel.
Yeah.
But it's so dark you can't see them.
Exactly. And the way I equate it to is those people that are walking through the tunnel with you, the ones that have been through it, are walking through it nods.
Yeah.
They can see, right? Because they've been down that road before.
That's a good point. That's a really, really good point. And it's not until you get towards the end where you see the light where, hey, look at all these people around me.
Exactly.
Mike, what do you think? What would you do different?
You know, we had this conversation right before we started airing today. My whole thing is I didn't talk to anybody at first.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're just talking about an incident. I'm not going to mention names or towns where an officer was involved in a critical incident and he was advised not to talk to anybody. I said, that's the worst thing possible.
I think so.
You got to talk to somebody that knows what's going on, like the resiliency officer program. You got to get into that in order to, you know, someone that has been down that road.
I'm pretty sure, and not knowing for certain on this one, that resiliency officers usually have their junk that they've been through.
Yes, because, you know, usually they're selected by the administration as people, as trusted individuals that, you know, are trusted by the rank and file,
mm-hmm.
and also trusted by the command staff.
Because you wouldn't be as effective as a resiliency officer had you not gone through all this stuff.
Oh, definitely not.
Right.
Well, you know, see, that's the whole thing. You got to go through the shit.
Yes.
And that's my problem. Right after my incident was going to talk to these doctors, I sat there the whole time saying, you went to fucking college. You didn't see what I fucking saw. You don't know what's going on in my head.
There's no bond. We had some people in here a couple weeks ago, and he runs it's a Christian men's group mentoring program.
Mm-hmm.
And the first question that he learned very quickly to ask his prospective mentors was, tell me what your suffering is. And he actually, before we even met, he actually used that term. Tell me what your suffering is. And because if they didn't have any suffering, they were usually very bad candidates, because then they got into a paternal relationship with a person where, look, kid, sit back. I've done, I'm going to tell you what's what.
Yep.
Where people who have been through some stuff have a tendency to walk through.
It's a been there, done that situation.
Right. Yes.
You know, if you haven't been there and done that, you don't know what's going on.
Exactly. And, you know, it's funny when you get people up there telling you, oh, this is what's going to happen, or telling you that they know better. And I'm like, Well, you haven't been.
Why? In just those because groups. You went to college?
Exactly. You haven't been there.
So yeah. We had somebody in. We had the former NYPD officer Michael Dowd in here.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you're aware who he is.
He's
the dirtiest cop in New York. You met him. Yeah. Actually, you met him at
the Blue Suicide.
So he's trying right now to do his penance and try to not right wrongs, but pay back. He wants to go into police academies and teach ethics. Now, think about the ethics training that you had. It was some lawyer who's never done a damn thing wrong.
I don't know if it's teach ethics. I think it's talk about ethics.
Talk about ethics. Talk about ethics.
I don't want an ethics class from Mike Dowd.
But who better to talk about the pitfalls and the dangers of ethics than somebody who did 12 years because he was unethical?
Yeah. What could happen if you're unethical?
Correct.
You know, he could just stand there and say, look at me.
Now, this is an easy question for me. During my critical incident time, the biggest mistake I made was giving my phone number to Mike Felice.
Could be it. Here we are.
I would change that in a second. I'd be like, I don't know who you are.
8 or 9 years
later. I'm sorry.
Later.
I lost my phone. I don't have a phone number anymore. No, in all honesty, what I chose, the path that I chose on how to deal with the pain that I was going through, this is what I would change. I've learned now to embrace that suffering because numbing it, running away from it, only makes it get bigger and bigger and bigger. Yep.
Because you're running away from reality.
Correct. And you if you can learn to just hug it, and you'd be all right.
It's called radical acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
You may not like the situation you're in, right? You may not like the suffering you're going through right now, but you know what? You got to accept it because it's reality, and reality is not going to change. The only way you can change reality, right, for yourself is by doing the next right thing. It's by having positive action over time. That's how you can change your reality moving forward, right? But you're not going to change it right then and there. It's going to take time.
And your job and what I try to speak to people about is if you can embrace that suffering, there's a couple things that are going to happen. You're going to come out of it pretty damn strong.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to come out of it with some bonds that are going to be more beneficial to you than family. They will be family.
1,000%.
Right. So suffering builds bonds. There's no question about that.
Well, mm-hmm. Even the group meetings we go to.
They're the best. They're our family.
They're all like family.
Oh.
They're all like family. We've all been through it. We poured out our souls, our heart and our souls to each other.
The worst text messages you'll ever see in your life.
Yeah. Okay.
The worst, most inappropriate text messages ever.
Oh, sure.
But that's how we speak to our family.
Yeah, because that's how we as cops,
yes.
That's how we deal with shit.
That's how we cope.
Exactly. It's our coping mechanism. Exactly.
It's crazy stuff.
Right.
You know, as a resiliency officer, I'm sure you get sent out to some really bad stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I know the last time you were in here, we always ask what the greatest suffering story is. But as a resiliency officer, without giving any names, mm-hmm. keep confidentiality, what do you think the worst trauma or suffering is that you have seen?
Without a doubt, it happened in January of this year. I got called out for a retired officer. He had been retired for about 2 years, and he was going through it. He had just lost a very close loved one. He was, already before that, he was experiencing severe PTSD.
Was it over time PTSD, or was it from an event?
It was from, I believe, two specific events, but everything just compounded over time. He never had the chance to process it. You know, I got called by the department's resiliency officer. Myself and about 15 of his closest friends from, you know, his department went on up to his house. He was on his way back from the funeral home because he was at the wake. And he's driving the car with his family. His wife is in the front seat, shooting text messages to one of the guys saying, all right, we're on the street, we're coming up to the house, da da da. When he pulled into the driveway, it was like we were doing a fucking search warrant. We all fucking came out of the bushes and shit like that. You know, it was about a foot and a half of snow on the ground, and we're trekking through the snow and shit. But we surrounded him. We said, all right, man, jig's up. We're gonna take you for help. He was ready to fight. He was combative. He was very emotional. He went from being very angry to being very sad very quickly and back to being angry. He knew everyone else who was there, but he didn't know me. And he focused in on me, and he was getting up in my face, screaming at me, who the fuck are you? Who are you? I don't know who the fuck you are.
tell you one thing, guy's got a pair of balls.
Right. He wasn't in the right mindset, I can tell you that.
You have to jump up to get in your face?
I basically looked at him and I said, I understand what you're going through. I get it. Right? You may not know me, but I know what you're going through. It took me basically grabbing onto him and him breaking down in my arms and me hugging him and saying, it's okay, brother. It's over. We're going to help you. We're here to help you. And we eventually got him to go into the ambulance. I was given a pair of handcuffs just in case. And thank God I had those because we had about a 35, 40 minute ride to the hospital. During that ride, he got very, very combative. We had to handcuff him, restrain him. And when he was at the hospital, he was very combative.
Which I can understand because for those people who have never been in a psych unit, I have.
Mm-hmm. That's all I.
Okay, so it's not fun. They treat you, you're not allowed to have a pencil.
They treat you like a fucking prisoner.
You're no shoelaces, no the food sucks. You're sleeping on a metal bed and anybody over 6 foot is not fitting on anything that they have. And it's horrible. You're dehumanized.
Exactly. Dehumanized. You're treated like a fucking animal.
Mm-hmm. That enough is to keep me from doing anything stupid.
1,000%.
I was going to say, how does that work in the patient's favor then? I mean, shouldn't you be more comfortable and be in a comfortable surrounding?
It doesn't. It just, it exacerbates everything.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
I mean, it did for me.
For me as well because, so when I was at the hospital, all I wanted to do is, I figured, okay, I'm beat. All I wanted to do was go to sleep. I wasn't even in a room yet. They were waiting for the admission. Mm-hmm. And the security guards are there. And so I'm trying to just, because there's a light shining in my eyes. So I'm trying to, and so the security guards come in there and they're being a little dickish, but I was being a big, giant dick to them. So I started.
No, not you.
No, dude, this is the biggest dick I've ever been in my life because I start ripping them for being security guards.
You and big dick don't go in the same sentence, but go ahead.
I start ripping them. I was not in my right mind. I was so combative. And
you were acting on emotion. As I said, you were in an irrational mindset.
A year and a half later, I actually went back and apologized to two of them that I could find because I called them. I'm like, you fucking rent a cop.
Badge.
You ain't doing nothing to me. Because I was out on workers' comp. However, I was in this freaking psych ward. It was horrible. Horrible.
I mean, when I walked in, they probably called about 3/4 of the security staff into the emergency room.
Yep.
Right. I mean, I wasn't angry. I wasn't combative. I was just tired because I was relieved that it was over.
The only part of me that was pissed when I was in there was I was pissed that I put myself in this situation.
Yes. Yeah.
I wasn't pissed at anybody else. No. I was pissed at myself.
And then I got pissed at a doctor who was in there. She came on up to me and she's talking to me, and she goes to me, I know what you're going through. My daughter dates a cop. She says, my daughter dates a cop. I know what you're going through.
I watched
CSI.
Yeah, right, CSI. I know exactly what you're going
through. And I looked at her and I said, go fuck yourself. You have no clue what the hell I'm going through, right? And then there was another incident where I'm filling out the paperwork to go to rehab. And I have a regular, like, Bic ballpoint pen.
I had this issue, too. I know exactly where you're going.
And this nurse comes over screaming, you can't have a pen. You could hurt someone with that. And I'm like, if you think I need this pen to hurt someone, I'm not the one who's crazy.
I'll twist your head off like a soda can.
I mean, come on. But
it's a sucky situation. But if you have somebody there to be honest with them.
Yes.
To be honest with them, maybe you'll make it a little less sucky. You're never going to take the suck out of it.
No, you're never going to take the total suck out of it. But you know what? Like the way this assistant prosecutor said, like maybe bring him through the back door.
Yeah. A little dignity.
Have him isolated from sight and sound.
A little dignity.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. Because you know what? They may see someone that they arrested. They may, you know, there's all these things that come into play. At least there you could have an officer. Like when I was there, I had four of my guys sitting with me the entire time. And it was the best thing that could have happened. Right. It was four of my best friends from work. I think it would have been a different situation if they weren't there. Being able to have someone there with them, accompanying them in that situation, I think is huge. And especially if it's someone who's actually been in that situation before, it's even better.
it goes back to not wanting to show weakness. Now you're in that psych ward. Now you're showing weakness.
So vulnerable.
And, yeah, now you're so vulnerable. And like you said, Brad, what if there's people in there that you locked up?
Yeah.
Well, when I went
Now you're showing true weakness to a guy that you locked up, that you were this big, strong person in front of.
But you know what it also shows? It also shows that we're human.
You're human. Exactly.
Right. We don't want to be vulnerable. But at the end of the day, we have to become vulnerable in order to get better.
Well, the vulnerability starts, we've all had our issues throughout our lives, and it starts somewhere and depends on how you're raised or how you grow up. Because we're here to talk about something that Brad and I had a phone conversation about. I'm like, wow, that'd be a great show. And it's trauma drama.
Mm-hmm.
It's that need to feel normal with trauma in your life.
Mm-hmm.
Certain people, I used to say this about police officers. There are certain police officers who get into this job and they have this big giant hole inside of them. And this is the genesis of this concept. They have this big giant hole inside of them. So they figure, you know what? Even before they were a cop. So they become a cop and they think that's going to fill the hole, but it doesn't fill the hole.
Nope.
So what do you do next? You go out and you get a girlfriend. Well, that doesn't fill the hole. Maybe if I get promoted, that hole will get filled. That doesn't work. So let me get another girlfriend. And it's just one thing after another. And all you're doing is creating drama in your life.
Exactly.
By trying to fill that hole that the trauma has caused.
That's fucking bottomless.
Yeah, it is. And it's just, it's ongoing.
Yeah.
It's a bottomless pit.
And what also, too, is we're so used to living our lives with that adrenaline rush. And that adrenaline rush contributes to that drama.
Well, that's part of an addictive behavior,
yeah.
Which is risk-taking.
Yes.
But again, that is the cause of something.
Yes.
We said this in a previous show, that people react to trauma in lots of different ways.
Mm-hmm.
A child will react to trauma in a certain way as different than an adult will, with the same root. I'll give you a for instance. If I take my son and I slap him across the face, what am I getting? I'm getting tears. I take you and I slap you in across the face. What am I getting? Mm-hmm. I'm going to get anger coming out of you. But it's the same trauma.
It's from the same, exactly.
It's from the same trauma.
Yep.
And it's funny to see how the evolution of the same cause evolve over time from tears, which is probably the most healthy reaction to trauma,
mm-hmm.
to anger.
Yes.
But us as men don't want to show tears.
Yes.
We're specifically talking about men.
Yeah.
Because women deal with trauma in much, much different ways. Mm-hmm.
They go shopping.
they spend their husband's money.
Yeah, no kidding.
You know, but trauma, the definition of trauma is a mental or physical stress, where the definition of drama is personal reactions to experiences and interpretation of events. And I pulled them right out of a dictionary. Mm-hmm. I'm not that good off the top of my head.
I saw you reading them off the paper. I was almost impressed at first, but
listen, in order to remember your name, I got to read it off the paper. I think the majority of Well, no, that's not exactly true, because I have seen women who have been wounded early on in their life with some really horrible, horrible shit. And then they find this need to continue that because they just don't feel normal otherwise without that trauma in their life.
Exactly. They don't feel normal without it because their lives have become normalized living with trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And if their lives, if they have something that is healthy for them in front of them, they'll bypass that. Could go to something that they know is unhealthy, but they still have a need and desire for it because that makes them feel normal.
Well, here's a great example. So we actually have joked about it on the show. It's always good to find a girl with daddy issues. So a girl with quote unquote daddy issues, well, maybe she created some trauma or she was abused a little bit when she was a child. So she gets involved in unhealthy relationships, usually with somebody that's older as a replacement for a father figure.
Mm-hmm.
So that's that proof of concept on that, where they need that. They, even though they're trying to run away from that, they kind of still need it.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you had a lot of drama growing up,
yes,
you're used to that.
Yes.
And you need that drama, like Kevin said, fill that hole. There are people that I know that need drama in their lives.
Oh.
And if there's no drama, they'll cause drama because it makes themselves feel comfortable.
There's the drama.
Yep.
And it was the funniest thing how this came about. So Brad and I are on the phone and we're just catching up. We're saying, you know, how you been? How you doing? And we just start talking about what we're doing and what's going on in our lives. And this conversation just came up. It's like, wow, you know, there's just people out there who need this. They create this stuff because it's an absence or a void in their life.
Negativity, mm-hmm. drama, and controversy.
Right. Women will produce it in certain different ways than men. Men will go for it, and I'm generalizing.
Yeah.
I'm generalizing. Men will do that risk-taking behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Women will do it in a much different way, which I'm sure we're all aware of as men. They'll create just scenarios. They'll ask you, how many girls have you slept with?
No.
really? Why are you even asking that question? It's going to end up bad.
Exactly. That's one of those questions that doesn't have a right answer.
No, there's no way to answer.
If you lie, they get mad at you because you're lying. Yep. If you tell them the truth, they get mad at you because you're telling the truth.
And maybe guys out there haven't had that situation, but I guarantee every guy, at least every heterosexual male out there has had, hey, does this dress look good? Yes, absolutely. Even if she looks horrible in it.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
You're trying to like social tact, you know?
Yeah.
Well, you know.
But then they'll say, you're just saying that.
Exactly.
Yeah. I am.
Or they'll try on like three and say, which one do you like the best? Well, I like the blue one. Well, what's wrong with the red one?
Exactly.
I'm more interested in your coming off than getting put on. How's that?
They all look good on the floor at the end of the night.
But at the end of the day, it's those personal reactions on how we deal with certain stresses. And I have to figure out, I'm trying to work through in my head where this stuff comes from, because you have to figure out what the genesis of it is in order to solve it.
Mm-hmm.
Because as a resiliency officer, I'm sure you see this. You go to certain damages mm-hmm. from in the police world, and that's never – like nobody ever – drunks don't become cops. I'm sure you've heard that one. Cops become drunks.
Okay.
Well, Mike has always been a drunk.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've been a drunk since I've been 15 years old.
So, okay, generally,
slip through the cracks.
Drunks don't become cops.
some slip through the cracks, but generally, it's the job and the stresses of the job that cause you to drink more and more and more and more.
Yeah.
And running away from the stress.
From the stress. Do you experience this where you're trying to find out what the root trauma is that's causing certain behaviors?
Oh, 1,000%. I had there was an officer that I had, I'll say back in April or May. He had 29 years on the job. He's saying, nothing bothered me. Nothing bothered me whatsoever. But yet he developed this addiction. I said, something had to happen in your life, or some event had to happen on the job.
So right? Full of shit.
And yeah. I called it out right away. I go, you're lying to me.
Yeah.
He's like, no, I'm good. I have no PTSD. I'm not fucked up from the job. I go, you're lying. And I asked him, give me some examples of jobs you've been on. And right away, he was able to rattle off like four right off the bat.
Serious ones.
Right? And I'm like, dude, you are able to rattle off jobs from when you were 9 months on the job, 29 years ago.
Can't tell me that didn't affect
you. That didn't affect you? Bullshit, because you remember every little thing right now.
Mm-hmm.
Because you think about it all the time. It's because we don't process it right away. We don't process the trauma. The way to process the trauma is to talk about it. Talk about it right when it happens. That way we can, work through it, okay? And it won't take up as much space in your brain.
Because when it hits you and you don't talk about it, it hits you like a hammer over the head.
Yes.
Because that's what happened to me.
Yes, exactly.
I was never prepared. And I'd forgotten this story from my shooting. I had some time off, which I thought, hey, great, got some time off. I'll go back Monday, fresh as a daisy, ready mm-hmm. to go to work. So my wife and I go out to the movies, and we watch this movie called This Is the End. It was a Seth Rogen movie. And there's one point in the movie where there's a loud bang, and people are just getting taken up to heaven. Well, that loud bang.
Oh, set you off.
It set me off. I started having a panic attack. I started breathing. Yep. I'm like, what the fuck? And nobody ever told me this shit. Like, what the fuck is
extreme
going on?
Extreme reactions to mild stimuli.
Holy, yep. I said, you know what? I'm going to go to the bathroom, figure out, calm down. 15 minutes later, I'm sitting out. I can't bring myself to go back in the theater. But I wish somebody would have said this stuff to mm-hmm. me. I wish somebody would have told me. Why aren't they talking about this in the police academies?
My daughter was running track during and after my incident. And one of the first track meets I went to, the starter pistol.
Oh, Christ.
Oh.
I had to look at the starter every time, for every race.
Yeah.
I had to look at the starter to see when the gun was going off. If I wasn't looking at him, I went out of my mind.
Oh, 1,000%.
That'll pucker your asshole.
Yeah, no. You got that right.
Yeah.
But I almost hit the deck.
So from your experiences, what kind of lifelong traumatic incidents do you think would cause something further down the road? Because that's an interesting one with that police officer. He was able, I've had experiences like that where you're able, these guys say, oh, I'm not bothered, but they're able to tell me every little detail.
I can draw from my own experience. It's only something I've been talking about recently because through my, you know, through my therapy and stuff like that, I was able to come on out. When I was a young kid, I was molested. When I was in special victims, right, for that time, every time I had to sit down and do a forensic interview and listen to a kid give me a disclosure, right, it triggered me. But was I going to say something? No, because I didn't want to be yanked out of the unit. I didn't want to be treated differently. I didn't want to be looked at differently. So I sucked it up and sucked on a bottle of Tito's, you know? And it wasn't until I was able to process it, things started making sense to me, right? And a lot of my behaviors started making sense as to why I was acting the way I was. Now I understand. I have a better understanding of my behaviors and why I acted the way I did. And going back to what you said about we should have this in the police academy, 1,000% we should. This should be a part of the basic training in the police academy is dealing with trauma. There's that book written by Dr. Kevin Gilmartin, you know, the hand guide, the law enforcement survival hand guide. It's mandatory reading for the FBI National Academy. It should be mandatory reading for every single police recruit because it's so needed. Because these kids are going out and they are, some of them with zero life experience, are going out into the street and going to be thrown into situations that are going to be high stress. And they're not going to know how to deal with the aftermath.
I talked to a guy, Kevin knows this, just a couple months ago, cop in New Jersey, 6 months out of the academy, was involved in a fatal shooting.
Yeah.
And I told him, I said, listen, I'm going to be straight up with you. That's something you're going to carry on for the rest of your career. It's not something, you know, it's how you deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's how you swallow it now. You know, that's something that you're going to remember for the rest of your career.
1,000%.
In the police academy, they know police work is a physical job.
Mm-hmm.
So what do they do in the police academy? They run you.
They run you.
They train you.
DT.
Most people, most police departments have a gym to keep you physically healthy. Yet this is a job where you know you're going to see traumatic events and stress.
They never work on the biggest muscle in your body.
They never, well.
Your brain.
Oh, that's the biggest muscle for you. It's different for me.
Yeah, here we go.
But they put all this emphasis on physicality, but what about the mental stress, which you're definitely going to see, whether you're in Mayberry or whether you're in Newark. Mm-hmm. You're going to see that stress.
Yes.
I don't understand this.
It's that old school mentality. And you know what? It's changing. The culture is changing. There are more chiefs out there who are embracing this. There are more cops out there who are understanding that, hey, you know what? We do need mental health in law enforcement and in the first responder world.
You know, that's what I was going to say. They didn't start embracing mental health until pretty much recently.
Yeah.
In law enforcement.
1,000%.
You know, back in the day, it used to be like, eh, don't worry about it.
I mean, I remember the AG's directive came out on my birthday, you know, August 6th in 2019. It came on out for the resiliency program.
August 6th. We got to remember that. We got to send them a card.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It came on out and it was, I thought it was a blessing. Yeah. I'm like, thank God. Finally, we're doing something to address this,
And if you think about it from a longevity standpoint or a business perspective from a police department, you want that officer to complete their 25 years.
Yes.
You trained that officer. You invested money and resources into them. Why wouldn't you want them to continue by having these resources there?
Yes.
That's why corporate centers are now putting gyms in because they know it lowers their health insurance costs. Mm-hmm. And if you have mental health awareness, you'll be able to keep – you won't have to waste that money on workers' comp and being out and going on retirement and having to train somebody new.
That's why you're seeing a lot of these police departments now, especially in the big major cities like New York City. They have a health and wellness unit, a dedicated health and wellness unit, that their sole purpose is to concentrate on the health and wellness of the officers for the New York City Police Department. And I think that every department should be having something like that because – it's needed, and it's going to save officers' lives because if they don't even if they make it to the 25 years and they retire, they're still going to carry the stress on for the rest of their lives. They're still going to carry that trauma for the rest of their lives.
Not to mention there's more officers like you than you would want to believe who have come from a traumatic childhood, who have had certain things, and they carry that junk onto the police department. And when you were a brand new officer, I'm sure it was pretty easy to keep those feelings down and to just abate them a little bit.
Oh yeah, because you're full of piss and vinegar and you just want to go out there and do the job.
Exactly.
Add on the job stress.
Yes.
And that glass is just going to spill over.
And all this started happening around the 10-year mark.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And if you look, you know, Cop to Cop puts out a thing about, you know, the stages of a career of a cop. They say most of the problems in an officer's career happen between the 10 and 15 year mark.
I've never read that, but it makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah.
Like I said, I mean, that piss and vinegar you were talking about probably lasts about 10 years. You're still taking care of your uniform in your first 10 years. And, you know, and you're seeing all these incidents and you're swallowing them and you're eating them and everything else. And then after the 10-year mark where people become wrangled old cops and you're seeing all the younger kids coming up, getting all salty, then maybe that's when it starts affecting you.
Yeah.
It's an amazing thing to just have that experience, and with that experience comes some damage. Wounded people, especially wounded during childhood, they like to eat their anxiety and they like to consume it and they like to perpetuate it, because we are here to talk about trauma drama. In your life, Brad, because again, talking about somebody else's life is pure speculation, so we draw on our own personal experiences. Mm-hmm. How did you perpetuate that drama after your initial traumatic incidents?
I was acting out sexually and stuff like that, especially later on in my life. You know, created a lot of drama in my life. That's for sure.
Finding new ways to fuck up.
Yeah, exactly. You know, just when you think that, you know, you're in the clear just when I thought I was in the clear from alcoholism, something else comes around and bites me in the ass.
You fuck up again.
Exactly. Right.
Do you think that's a way that the trauma skews our interpretation of how we're supposed to live our life?
Yeah, 1,000%. I totally believe that.
Because, you know, I've heard this over and over again where people just, they keep getting into trouble, and they've had some really damaged past, and they just say, oh, I'm a fuck up. I'm just a fuck up. Well, it's usually a cause of something.
Yes.
Because you're interpreting the world through these eyes of a broken and wounded person. So how do you think you were able to overcome that stuff?
By, number one, going to therapy, a lot of therapy. When I went away to Sierra Tucson, that's something I focused on, was that stuff. Finding ways to cope with it other than acting out. We have to have all these tools in our toolbox, right? For every single situation that we encounter. We may not need them right this second, but maybe 5, 10, 15 years down the road, we may need to reach into that toolbox and pull it out. And I learned also by listening to a lot of speakers, a lot of podcasts about this stuff, trying to pull away stuff from those speakers and podcasts and dumping them into my toolbox, and also going to the Fellowship of AA. When you hear people speak, but wow, that's a great way to handle that. I may not need that now, but, you know, 5, 10, 15 years down the road, I may need that, and I can draw on that experience, strength, and hope that person just shared.
The same theory of what we were talking about before. Someone who's gone through it before.
Exactly.
Is going to help you out more than someone who hasn't gone through it.
1,000%.
So I'm an avid note taker.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not taking notes now because it's all recorded and I can go back and listen to it. But when I'm out listening to somebody speaking, and I have a tendency to do it on my phone because it's the easiest thing that's available, I'll just write down notes. And people, I've actually gone up to people afterwards. Look, I wasn't playing around on my phone. I was actually writing notes. What you're
saying? Look at his jerk off texting while I'm talking.
Right. But I just did it the other day where I was writing on my phone. I was taking notes and I had to go up at person afterwards, because we can pull these experiences and these just little nuggets of information that we can use down the road.
Exactly.
And I do it all the time.
You brought up the toolbox theory. You should go through life with like a toolbox. And for every experience you get another tool.
Mm-hmm.
You put it in that toolbox. So if, God forbid, the same thing comes up, you can go in that toolbox and there's that tool to fix what you went through years ago.
And then the best thing about that is, right, you have that toolbox And then when you encounter someone who's going through the same shit, you can lend them
tools. You can lend them tools.
It's like, oh, yeah, I have this.
Here's this tool that you need for this situation. Yeah. Go and use it.
Go and use it, right?
Just return it.
Yeah.
I think, especially people who don't learn from their experiences, they never learn to put that tool in their toolbox. Or either they're not taught how to use that tool.
Or they drop it near the toolbox. Yeah. So when they go in the toolbox, they can't get it.
And that's where that post-traumatic growth comes in. That's where the resiliency comes in. Because it's not about bouncing back. It's about bouncing back and growing from that and learning from it. That's that post-traumatic growth. That's what you want. You could just bounce back and you're bound to repeat the same shit because you're coming back right to the same level.
Right.
You know what I mean? Right? But if you grow from it, you know, and learn, that's where you're going to get better. That's where you're going to improve yourself.
Well, there's that hope issue. I think Lee Rusan puts it best because he tells me this all the time. The past is history. The future is a mystery. The hope of things can get better, that the sun does rise tomorrow.
Yes.
People understand that you can go out there and change your stars and change the trajectory of your life by moving forward and growing.
Mm-hmm. You can, you're the author of your own book. You can write it any way you want.
Mike's is a children's book.
Crayons.
Yeah, just so you know. It's like a Green Eggs and Ham type of thing. It's not very interesting to read.
Sam, I am.
This is the type of helpful information and helpful conversation that people who have gone through these things in the past need to hear. Because here we are with three damaged and dented individuals who are moving forward with their lives in a different trajectory. We're not stuck in that same rut and we're having some fun doing it. We're laughing. It doesn't have to be all serious every single time.
No.
And people need to understand that, that going to therapy doesn't have to be this, I got to go to therapy. I got to relive everything.
I fucking look forward to it.
Yeah.
I honestly look forward to my weekly sessions with my doc.
I used to like to go to Dr. Steph. Dr. Steph was fun because although you'd sit there and he would work certain things out of you, you'd have a good time doing it.
No, yeah.
The funny thing is, too, is I don't think we've ever left a Dr. Steph group or an individual meeting. We didn't laugh at least two or three times.
Oh.
That, you know, and that's, it's funny. It's funny you talk about laughing. That's the exact same way that Doc Schlosser is, right? When, yeah, because he comes up and he speaks quite often with me. He'll stand next to me and he'll be like, "Do you believe that I had this Viking-looking motherfucker scared as shit before he came in?" He goes, "This little fat Jewish guy, right, had him scared as shit." Right?
Yeah, because he could sign off, no longer able to be an officer.
But you know what, though? I went in there frightened. Frightened to the core. And I came out laughing my ass off. And every single time I have an interaction with him, I'm laughing my ass off. Right? Because he has that ability to do that. But you know what? You're also laughing your ass off, but you're learning a shit ton also.
You're not going to learn anything if you're upset or you're, you know, you're
yeah.
So laughter, and if I was sitting in that therapist chair and that person started laughing, well then, okay, they're starting to bring their guard down.
Yeah, the wall's coming down. Exactly.
And they're starting to absorb some of the information that they're getting. So I think laughter is essential.
1,000%. Yeah.
You know, a lot of times it's, you're laughing at yourself too.
I do that quite often.
Yeah.
Even some of the best therapists you clash with, even if they're great therapists.
I mean, you know, not everyone's going to get along with everyone.
So how do we start healing the people who create the drama out of trauma? The trauma.
Embracing it?
Yeah. Embracing it and openly talking about it.
I think openly talking about it is key.
Owning it.
I'm a big ownership guy. I'm a big Jocko Willink fan.
Yeah, exactly.
So.
You know, extreme ownership. You got to own it, right?
You fuck up, you own it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that's like what happened with me. Like, listen, I fucked up. I took ownership of it. I know that I lost a lot of trust from a lot of people in my office, from the higher ups on down. What's the only way you can gain trust back is positive action over time, right? And that's what I'm doing on a daily basis. They may not be directly seeing it, but you know what? It's getting back to them.
Well, it's nice that you're not asking for that forgiveness or that trust because you can't ask for that.
No,
stuff.
You can't
give trust.
Yeah.
Trust is earned.
It's earned.
So it's nice. I guess that's the way to combat that trauma is to, I'm not going to show you how, or I'm not going to tell you how this stuff's going to go down. I'm going to show you through my actions.
Exactly. It's like, it's almost like making a living amends.
Yeah.
Right. You know, you got to do it every single day, especially with me. You got to practice what you preach.
Yeah. You've learned from your own trauma drama.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And we've all had it sometimes. We've all had it. The further you get into trauma drama, you get into the woe is me type of attitude, you get into I'm just a fuck up, and it just goes down and down and
down. I mean,
down.
Don't get me wrong. I still think like that sometimes,
yeah.
Right? But I'm able to recognize it, you know, talk to some people.
Well, you have resources now.
Yeah, and snap out of it,
yeah.
You know. And I tell my coworkers that, listen, if you see me acting like this, fucking smack me upside the head and be like, listen, get your head out of your ass.
It's funny. I was just listening to something about that. It's a reset of a carburetor. There are certain people who are used to physical pain that when they need a little to calm down or a little bit of clarity of thought, this is a different type of trauma drama. When they need a little clarity of thought, they want to get hit. Because he said it was like, you know, when you start up a small engine, you got the carburetor all the way up, and then once it warms up a little bit, you pull the carburetor down, and it just idles perfect. Mm-hmm. Well, certain people need their carburetor reset, and the only way to get it reset is to go in there and take a beat. Or some people need to go roll on the mat if they're jujitsu guys,
yeah.
Or get into the ring if they're boxers.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen it numerous times. Because that pain that you experience.
Or even go, you know, go do an intense workout at the gym.
That's another way to do it.
I was just going to say that too. I mean, just go beat yourself up at the gym.
Go for
you
a
don't
run.
Have to get beat up by someone else.
Yeah.
You could beat yourself up. Go to the gym. Go for a heavy run. Go for, you know.
It's an interesting way to combat, especially for me, it was an easy way to combat mental trauma. But it's also just, it just reset me and centered me a little bit.
Yeah, reset your brain because of all the, you know, all the chemicals that are produced by that physical exertion and stuff like that, it just, you know, goes to your brain and resets it.
So when people work their way out of this trauma drama like you have yourself, did you learn anything from it? Did you figure out a roadmap on how some pitfalls that you would advise other people to ignore?
Yeah. Number one, you have to know yourself. And that's what I did. I learned a lot about myself. And knowing what makes me tick, right? And
what ticks you off.
And what ticks you off, exactly. You know, your triggers.
Your triggers, yeah.
Because you can't go through life without experiencing triggers. It's going to happen no matter what. But it's your reaction to them, right? That's what you have control over. Learning to control your reactions and controlling your actions is a huge thing for me. That was probably the number one thing that I had to do. You know, I know that when I came across a stressful situation or something like that, I can no longer turn to a bottle. Because that's what I used to do, right? I used to turn to a bottle. Can no longer act out in certain ways, right? I need to go talk about it. I need to, a big thing too is call my sponsor, right? Call people in my sober network.
You got to also ask yourself, is there any former way of coping with your past trauma, did any of it work?
No. Because if it worked, I wouldn't fucking be here.
But then we still do. the funny thing is we keep doing it, even though it doesn't work.
Because it would give us that immediate, because we became addicted to it. And it gave us that immediate gratification that we were looking for. Knowing full well that the long-term effects were going to be detrimental to us. But we were seeking that initial, immediate gratification.
You know, that's like the saying, you knock on devil's door long enough, someone's bound to answer.
Yeah.
So you just keep knocking on devil's door.
Mm-hmm.
Someday someone's going to answer. And I don't know if that's when you hit rock bottom, but that's when maybe something snaps and you say, okay, now I got to get.
Yeah.
It's an amazing thing. Brad, we're coming to the end of this thing, and I really want to thank you for coming in here again and giving us your expertise. You see more than your share, and you see more than you should. And I hope, I know for a fact that you're taking care of yourself mentally.
Oh, you have to first. That's number one. You can't help anyone else if you're not taking care of yourself.
That's first day of the academy, yep. Right?
Well, Brad, like I said, I mean, you're a big supporter of the program. You're a big friend of the program, and I truly appreciate everything you do.
No, I appreciate what you guys are doing. You guys are rolling out great information every week. you're the voice of those, you know, who are suffering. You're getting the, experience, strength, and hope of others out there so others can listen. And by that, people are seeing, oh, you know what? I'm not alone. Right. And that's a big thing, because when you're in that deep, dark place, you think you're alone.
The great thing for Mike and I, and I'm sure it's for Mike, although he's never said it, is we just get this great education. Like, you go to all these resiliency officer classes and you learn these little different things, and we pull information out of every single different show, and we've learned some stuff. I'm able to
the best free education we've ever gotten.
Yes.
It's true.
And I'm able to pull stuff out during a regular conversation with my friends, and I'm like, how the fuck did you know that? How the fuck did you know that?
Yeah, and especially with you, Brad, too, like going to all these different resiliency things, you're learning every day. You're learning something new in different ways.
And what's crazy is when I teach this stuff, I learn something new. You know, it's like when you watch a movie. You could watch fucking Step Brothers 1,000 fucking times.
And see something new.
And see something new.
I do it all the time.
Right? Monty Python, the Holy Grail. I see something new every time I watch it.
Exactly. That's exactly what it's like.
Well, Brad, I can't thank you enough for coming in here. It's always great talking to you, and I know we're going to see each other in the future because we're always at the same places.
Yep.
So that's going to bring us to the end of this episode. Let's talk about...
Brad, don't laugh at him when he fucks up the closing.
Go fuck yourself. Thank you all for listening. Let's think about all the stuff that we learned today. You have to process trauma by talking it out. Mike is a fucking dickhead, and there's nothing we can do about it.
That hasn't changed yet, so it's not going to change.
There are those who walk alongside you even in the darkest days. Healing's hidden face is laughter. But most importantly, you don't need to perpetuate the drama caused by trauma. And that's going to do it for this episode of the Suffering Podcast, The Suffering of Trauma Drama with Brad Waudby. Follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, and we will see you on the next episode of the Suffering Podcast.